The footage in this video that you have been watching is actually taken from one of my own trips into an underground church that was once a mine. We don't even know the abilities of mankind in these days. We really don't. We don't know what these men who were closer to creation, we don't know what they were actually capable of. We don't know how tall they were. We don't know what powers they had. And that is that while giant bodies perished, the spiritual corruption associated with them did not. And in that sort of mindset, the Antediluvian Giant Order was destroyed physically, but its influence endured in a spiritual, cultural, or unseen form somehow. Maybe it came back from the deep after the waters sort of went down and the dry land appeared again. Perhaps it crawled up out of the deep. These demons, or these monsters. Dr. Chan published this book, The Adam and Eve Story, but it's not interesting because it's about our original mommy and daddy. It's interesting because it soon disappeared from public access after the CIA classified it. The book talks about big disasters like pole shifts and mass extinctions and the repeated destruction of advanced civilizations. So to say that it's impossible, quite frankly, is just not very intelligent. As a matter of fact, it's so unintelligent that I can't help but wonder if it's propaganda. It seems like a critical component to kind of understanding how things survived floods.
Hello, citizen. This content creator discusses controversial topics. To properly engage in this content, an open mind is required. There's something very strange about this man. The words he says, the things he does. Is he perhaps a glitch in the system? Is he a rogue federal agent? Is he actually alive? Is he a lunatic, unhinged and on the loose? Can anyone even stop him? He is one of the internet's most mysterious men of mystery. He is a man who has seen his own death and lives life on the run, surviving out of spite and because he's not superstitious, but he is a little stitious.
The earth is hollow. The poles long sought are phantoms. There are openings at the northern and southern ends. Inside the earth are vast continents, oceans, mountains, and rivers. In this new world, there is plant and animal life, and it is probably populated by races unknown to the inhabitants of the earth's surface.
Thus the heavens and the earth were reestablished, all the host of them. And on the seventh day, the recovery from the Holocaust and flood were complete. And the seventh day brought rest from the fight for survival against the Holocaust and its after effects. And the seventh day brought God's blessed peace, as the Holocaust had abated, leaving those of his creation who survived. These are the same regenerations of the heavens and of the earth as they were reestablished after the tumble, previous to the one of this story, when the Lord God reestablished the earth and the heavens. And every plant of the field before that cataclysm was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew. For the Lord God had not brought rain upon the earth in this region, and there was not a man to till the ground. But there was this cataclysm, and great inundations arose over the earth, and it was God's will that man should rise up from the earth and keep the breath of life, and remain a living soul. This is his story. And it was God's will, after a cataclysm, that a continent eastward be established, and there in Eden lived the man of this story. And from this land grew other civilizations, on other lands, with the motherland in the midst of all being the seat of wisdom, of all knowledge, both good and evil. And the inundation destroyed Eden, and left only its four offspring lands. And it was in God's province that the man was of Eden, where he lived and toiled, and he was descended from the original mankind which settled that motherland. And God's design was that the man was warned, although the motherland was the source of all knowledge, both good and evil, if he stay therein, surely he would die. And it was God's design that the man should not be alone, therefore a mate should be his. And since God had originally created every beast of the field and fowl of the air, and in his time Adam had named each one. And Adam gave names to all cattle, and to the fowl of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was no mate. For Adam's mate had died after giving birth to a child of Adam, and the child of the man was a female, made in the image of God, intended. And Adam said, "This child is bone of my bone, and flesh of my flesh." And she grew into womanhood. Therefore the man was both father and mother to her, and she abode with him, as they were one flesh. And the climate there was warm, requiring little or no clothing. Now at the time of the beginning of this story, the oceans were in their normal state of quietness, and it was known to the woman of this story that she was not descended from any of the peoples of the land which sprang from the mother continent. And God's design was that the woman would learn that the people of the offspring lands would live on, but the people of the motherland, from whom she had descended, would surely all die. And she knew that, in spite of the impending inundation, she would not surely die, for God's design was that from the day she was born, she was descended from the original mankind of the motherland, and was destined to know all, to discern both good and evil. And the woman, being of the motherland, and being wise and good, knew that both she and her father were descended from the original mankind of the motherland. And they both were wise, and had lived the good life. And it was that time of the year when some clothing was needed for warmth. And in the cool of those days, when they were wondering to which of the offspring lands they should go, and God's presence was felt strongly by them, Adam felt God's call, and said, "I have heard God's warning since the summer, and have feared, for I knew not where to find refuge." And God's warning had come to him in the summer, as a warning to leave the land of his ancestors. One really does have to ask whether or not it's good to hyper-focus on the intimate details of such big events, like that of Genesis creation. It doesn't really change a thing whether we know every little small detail or not. And what I just read was not the real story of Genesis, as anybody who has read the real story of Genesis actually knows. And it's not even a story that I'm really sure I could find myself believing in, as I haven't truly abandoned the idea of Adam as the first man. This was a retelling with the imaginative embellishing of human imagination, but it highlights a detail of preservation that is worth noticing and considering when pondering all the other apocalypses and mini apocalypses that have occurred since the dawn of mankind. If Watchers descended, Nephilim came to be, and the earth is manipulable, all things that we as believers believe are valid statements, then they would have quickly figured out how to bury things deep within the earth to keep those things safe, right? Seems only natural, even we do that. These things would stand the test of time in underground hiding places, perhaps thousands of years longer than we know. Just look at what we actually do unearth through archaeology, or better yet, look at the things we are actually capable of burying underground, like, you know, deep underground military bases. And if we can do that, well then, yes, there are most definitely cities underground. Which makes the Hollow Earth theory at least a little bit real. It's real. It's not even something that you need help imagining, because if you've ever been in a tunnel, then you have been inside the Earth. So, this story of Adam and Eve, not only is it an interesting sort of tale about how this cycle repeats over and over and over, it's also an interesting example of how man, growing tired with the story given by God, will attempt to rewrite that story. Not only is this story of Adam and Eve being rewritten, but the Watchers and the Nephilim attempt to rewrite the story every single day of our lives. In the 1960s, Dr. Chan published this book, The Adam and Eve Story, but it's not interesting because it's about our original mommy and daddy. It's interesting because it soon disappeared from public access after the CIA classified it. The book talks about big disasters like pole shifts and mass extinctions and the repeated destruction of advanced civilizations. It stayed mostly hidden until some parts were released years later. And now, for some reason, only 57 pages are available, and they are heavily edited, leaving many questions about what the book really says, what may have been inside it that the CIA was interested in, and how close to home this book really hits. People are curious, obviously, as am I, about why this book might be considered dangerous and why the CIA wanted to keep it a secret, so much so that I'm not even the first person to talk about this, although I did find it accidentally. Chan Thomas's The Adam and Eve Story reads like a literal fever dream. It reads like a man who's trying desperately to come up with any other way that it could have possibly gone down. The central premise of the book is that every several thousand years, the Earth's crust just suddenly slips over its molten core, sort of like a loose orange peel rotating around the fruit underneath. And this pole shift has the ability to cause earthquakes and volcanic eruptions and weather patterns so violent that they make the disaster at Pompeii look like nothing more than some kind of fender bender. And according to Thomas, these cycles of destruction, they reset human civilization and they erase all traces of our existence, except, you know, a lucky few who repopulate the world afterward, or the Nephilim who go inside the earth, etc., etc. He suggests that this is how we got the story of Noah and the myth of Atlantis. In short, Thomas basically claimed that human history is a repeating loop of high civilization being smacked back to the Stone Age every few millennia by Mother Earth's cosmic etch-a-sketch reset, but it's all part of God's plan. He believes that it's all part of God's plan, and there are just different iterations of mankind, and the story of the Bible is the story of this iteration of mankind. And Genesis and the creation story is the story of this, the creation of this newest iteration of man, okay? But every few thousand years, God may just simply give us a new iteration of man, right? Now, we as Christians believe in prophecy, and the Bible continually prophesizes itself. It does not care whether the words were stated in the Old Testament or the New Testament. If a prophecy is said, it will be fulfilled. Okay? So there are various like things that we need to consider between Jesus and Adam and, you know, redemption and all that kind of stuff, and not get too wrapped up in the idea that God just starts over and over and over and over. He might. We don't know the ways of God, okay, but they are perfect and they are good. But it does raise a lot of questions when you consider the fact that there may have been more man than we might have realized. And it's also interesting how, even if the entire story of mankind doesn't reset, what Chan does display here is something that I've always talked about, and that's how there are isolated regions in the world that will experience apocalypses all on their own. It doesn't have to be a global catastrophe. And even if it is a global catastrophe, whether it's global or whether it's isolated regions, those catastrophes will cause people to go underground because that's the only place that they can go to be safe. Or at least that's what they feel when impending doom is on the horizon. And I believe that that's true of the Nephilim as well, of course, and they went inside the earth during the flood because the flood didn't flood the whole world over all at the same time simultaneously. The Bible says it takes time for this to happen. It takes time for the waters to cover the earth. So messages are going to be spread. We have spiritual beings in the earth. We have giants with spiritual abilities. We have fallen angels. We have watchers. We have all the, we don't even know the abilities of mankind in these days. We really don't. We don't know what these men who were closer to creation, we don't know what they were actually capable of. We don't know how tall they were. We don't know what powers they had inherently because they were closer to the first man. We don't know any of that kind of stuff, you know, and the firmament was still up, all that kind of stuff. We don't know what their abilities, the abilities of man actually were. But needless to say, the abilities of all three of these classes of creatures, they probably had the ability to send messages. They probably had the skills, the know-how to send messages. And in the case of spiritual entities, I would assume that they could send those messages, spiritually. Which would mean that some might have had the opportunity to quite literally escape inside the earth. Parts of this Adam and Eve story book remained under wraps until 2013, when a declassified version was released and people noticed that it had been completely sanitized. Entire chapters were missing, pages had vanished, and so one imagines that a CIA analyst was just poring over this, redacting it with the enthusiasm of a teenager with a highlighter and a final exam that he didn't study for. He's just going over random things, it would seem, classifying things, and totally butchering this book. When top secret government entities classify a part or all of a book, they can't explain why they classify it, or they might as well admit the truth or their concern about the very thing that they are trying to keep under wraps. Thomas was in fact employed in the aerospace industry, and some of his background research, I guess it's possible, could have overlapped with classified materials, and it's not impossible that the CIA's interest wasn't about the pole-shifting madness or something like that, but about something else, like an appendix in the book that maybe inadvertently referenced sensitive satellite data or defense technologies or, I don't know, even atmospheric phenomena that may be under military study or something like that, in which case the classification was less because this man has predicted the end of the world or something like that, and more, oops, he mentioned that thing we weren't supposed to be acknowledging in public at this time because that information has not been released widely yet, and we don't want to get exposed. Something like that. But that wouldn't explain why they would go through all of these pages and sort of tear the whole thing apart. And of course, there's always this more entertaining explanation, which is that the CIA knows something. And if you're the kind of person who keeps a bug-out bag, or has bookmarked maps or something, escape routes planned, drop sites, something like that, then you might be like me, and you might believe that the government classified the book because it actually tells a truth of some sort, a terrifying truth. And maybe it's cyclical, maybe it's about Earth's periodic temper tantrums, or maybe it's something else. It doesn't really matter to me what it is. What matters to me is that this happened. But regardless, in this theory, the redactions weren't just editorial. They were essentially strategic omissions to prevent perhaps a mass hysteria, because we all know what happens when the people of the 2000s enter into a state of mass hysteria. There is a very dramatic toilet paper shortage. This is predictable. This is a thing that mankind has decided is above food, above water. This is an article that people now rely on more than they rely on God, more than they rely on faith. They rely on toilet paper. And so when mass hysteria hits, make sure you got yours. We don't really know what's going on with Chan. We don't know why they classified his book. We don't know why they tore it to pieces. We don't know what they were looking for or what they found or what Chan put in there or maybe what he didn't. CIA will probably keep that secret forever because they just really have no reason to disclose why they classified it in the first place. But it is pretty suspicious, if you ask me. What is known is that most people who claim to have visited the inner lands say that they've reached them through old mine shafts, caves, and underground tunnels. And other people also claim to have traveled through great volcanic systems. We have that situation in Iceland where there are tunnels that were dug by somebody. Nobody knows who. They estimate somewhere around 10,000 years ago, people were digging tunnels in this volcanic region. kind of weird. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what people say. Then you've got things like the Bermuda Triangle and other areas of the world like that. There's one in the in Lake Michigan as well, so maybe I'm closer than I know. These places are said to provide additional entrances to the inner worlds within their murky depths. In Moongate, suppressed findings of the U.S. space program, which came out in 1982, nuclear engineer and researcher William Bryan presents evidence that the moon, like any hollow sphere, rings when it's struck by asteroids or by heavy space debris. But that's not all, because according to Dr. Bryan, the evidence of the Apollo seismic experiments also indicate that the moon is hollow and pretty rigid. He also reports it's not generally known that the Earth exhibits the same bell-like ringing or reverberation as the moon, since the Earth is about 81 times more massive than the moon. A much greater explosion, as you can imagine, or shockwave is required to produce the same effect. A guy named Joseph Gudavage, in his book Astrology, the Space Age Science, also points to the hollow moon. He notes that the ringing effect was recorded during the Chilean earthquake of May 22, 1960. Supposedly, this was the strongest earthquake recorded since official world records began in 1881, so it's a pretty big boy. And he cites a description given at the 1961 World Earthquake Conference in Helsinki, according to which the shaking was so strong that the entire planet rang like a bell. In 1959, Professor Iosif Shklovsky reportedly presented findings on the moons that are orbiting Mars and concluded, after carefully weighing the evidence, that both were hollow. Now, some, of course, orthodox scientists admit that even though certain celestial bodies may be hollow, that doesn't mean all of them are. They also refuse to accept that all planets and moons are naturally hollow, and kind of rush to add that such bodies must therefore be artificial satellites. But a lot of people ask how the hollow Earth could even be real. They say it's against the laws of science and all sorts of stuff. People scramble to say it's not real. And honestly, I'm not sure why, because I don't think anyone argues about whether or not caves are real, whether or not tunnels are real, whether or not deep underground military bases are real. I don't know. I've been in a lot of underground places and seen a lot of underground things. And let me tell you, when you're underground, it certainly feels like you are in the hollow earth, okay? So I don't think anybody's arguing about whether or not these things are real, because they are. And the footage in this video that you have been watching is actually taken from one of my own trips into an underground church that was once a mine. The Salt Cathedral of Zipaquirá is an underground Roman Catholic church. It's built within the tunnels of a salt mine that is 200 meters underground in a mountain in Cundinamarca, Colombia. And it's a place of pilgrimage. While there, I've also been in all sorts of other types of underground locations, including emerald mines and diamond mines. And let me tell you, those guys over there, those Colombians, know how to go underground. So I can't imagine how somebody who's lives depend on it might attempt to go underground, probably pretty aggressively. If there was a global flood, probably pretty intensely. If you're not going to get to outer space or climb the tallest tree in the world, then you might want to start going underground. And there are stories of people being trapped under the ocean in boats with tiny pockets of air for days. Same things in caves and coffins and pretty much anything else that can be submerged or buried. So, remember those coffins? Those coffins in Egypt? Those gigantic coffins that they were saying were for monsters? Some people think that those might have been for Nephilim. Some other people say that those were storage containers for books and things that were necessary to survive the flood. Okay? So there's a lot going on here. There's a lot of ways that things could have survived the flood by going into the earth. So to say that it's impossible, quite frankly, it's just not very intelligent. As a matter of fact, it's so unintelligent that I can't help but wonder if it's propaganda. It seems like a critical component to kind of understanding how things survived floods and apocalypses throughout time. Not just floods, all sorts of apocalypses. So how did the Nephilim, giants, or anything for that matter, survive the flood and countless other tragedies? They may be dug into the earth. The most coherent way to approach this question is not to imagine the flood as a gradual storm that caught the giants unprepared. In Genesis, the flood is presented as an immediate and decisive act of divine judgment, right? The fountains of the great deep are broken up, and the windows of heaven are open, and the catastrophe begins with this magnificent force. Although the rain continues for 40 days and 40 nights, and the waters continue to rise over time, the event itself is introduced not as a slow natural process, but actually as a sudden rupture in the created order in the book of Genesis. But I think that distinction is important because it suggests that if the giants existed as part of the corrupt powers of the antediluvian world, which we know that they did, they may have had warning of the coming judgment without having any true means of escaping it. If one accepts the interpretation that supernatural beings were indeed involved in the corruption described in Genesis 6, then it's reasonable to consider that the powers behind that corruption may have understood, at least in part, that judgment was approaching. It was a coming. Even Noah functioned as a sort of visible public warning. But it was also possible to imagine that the giant orders received knowledge of the coming destruction through other means, through their watcher progenitors, through omens, through dreams, or through forms of hidden knowledge associated with the fallen world that they inhabited and wreaked havoc upon. So for that reason, the central issue is not merely whether they were warned. The more important question is how they may have responded once that warning became clear. And I think that one possibility is that some attempted to evade judgment by retreating to elevated regions. We have a lot of fables and stories and myths and legends about the last survivors before the flood climbing to the tops of the tallest mountains, climbing to the tops of the tallest trees, reaching up to the stars and grabbing hold. We have all sorts of stuff like that. Because the waters did not cover every high place instantly. So the giants probably did, and a lot of other things, probably did flee to mountains and fortified strongholds and cliffs or cave systems in the hope, in a last-ditch effort to survive the initial stages of this global catastrophe that was coming. But this theory can only function as kind of a temporary explanation because Genesis ultimately states that even the high hills under the whole heaven were indeed covered. So there probably wasn't anywhere, unless the Bible is not exactly being 100% literal here, there probably wasn't anything on the surface of the earth. They would have had to gone inside. Any strategy of upward retreat, therefore, would have amounted only to delay, not a true escape, unless you could get all the way to space, I guess, into the air for an extended amount of time, or into another dimension, into another realm. A second possibility is that some looked for refuge in the ground. They buried, they dug in, and this is where the theory becomes pretty complex and pretty fascinating. The flood is described as originating not only from above through the opening of heaven, but also from below through the breaking up of the fountains of the great deep. And those words seem to suggest that the world beneath the surface was not viewed as a neutral domain. In biblical thought, the deep is often associated with chaos or confinement or some sort of primordial disorder. So if the giants had access to subterranean regions and ancient chambers and cavern systems or hidden places beyond ordinary human reach, well, it's not that inconceivable that some may have attempted to withdraw into the earth rather than remain exposed upon it. But this doesn't amount to proof that they survived underground. Scripture doesn't make that claim directly either, but it does leave open the possibility that the visible terrestrial order was judged in a way that does not fully explain every question that we have that is connected to the hidden regions of the deep. So this brings us to an interpretive point that makes the subject especially significant. Genesis is precise in the way that it describes what perished. The text repeatedly refers to life upon the earth, upon the face of the ground, in the dry land, and to those creatures possessing the breath of life in their nostrils, okay? The emphasis is overwhelmingly terrestrial. The language is directed toward the land world. By contrast, the text doesn't seem to frame the destruction of marine life in the same explicit terms. The Bible doesn't seem to explicitly teach that sea creatures, abyssal beings, or aquatic monsters survived the flood in any special sense. It doesn't say that. What it does seem to show is that the formal language of judgment is aimed most directly at land-dwelling life. So as a result, if there were beings already associated with the deep, with the abyss, with the waters below, Scripture doesn't really close that interpretive possibility as decisively, you could say, as it closes the question of life upon the land. And I guess you could argue, well, the ground underneath the ocean is the surface of the earth, so everything died in that way. But there would have to be like some kind of weird explosions or something going on under the water, right? Like when the fountains of the deep ruptured, perhaps it was like an underwater nuclear explosion or something and it just killed everything. I don't know, but there probably would have had to have been unique and special situations in order for all of the marine life to die. So essentially that is the basis for the idea of a loophole. The flood may have been total with respect to the visible civilization of the surface world while still leaving unresolved questions about what belonged to the deep. And at the same time, even if one rejects the idea that any embodied giant survived in a cave or some abyssal refuge, there's still that difficulty because the biblical record continues to speak of giants after the flood. The Nephilim are mentioned before the flood, but after the flood, the text still refers to giant peoples and figures such as the Anakim, the Rephaim, the Amim, the Zamzamim, Og, king of Bashan, right? It says they were here before and after the flood. So whatever conclusion one reaches, the giant problem obviously clearly persists in the biblical imagination. And I think this leaves several theoretical possibilities. One is that a remnant genuinely survived in hidden locations in the earth, probably. Most likely, most definitely inside of the planet itself, burrowed in like a parasite. And another is that a similar incursion occurred again after the flood, which I think is also a possibility, like essentially another wave of corrupt watchers or angels in general came down to further create Nephilim. I think that's probably a possibility. And another is that corrupted traits persisted through human bloodlines in some kind of reduced form, which is what gives rise to my NPC theory. But there's still another, and perhaps this is the most theologically unsettling possibility. And that is that while giant bodies perished, the spiritual corruption associated with them did not. And in that sort of mindset, the antediluvian giant order was destroyed physically, but its influence endured in a spiritual, cultural, or unseen form somehow. Maybe it came back from the deep after the waters sort of went down and the dry land appeared again. Perhaps it crawled up out of the deep. These demons, or these monsters, especially if they were already in the deep to begin with and hadn't necessarily trespassed upon mankind yet, you could see them sort of venturing outward after this great cataclysm to see what the hell is going on. So we come to the conclusion then that the giants didn't most likely just escape the flood in some crude or simplistic way. The flood appears to have destroyed the public and visible order of the giants, the violent and corrupt civilization that had filled the earth. But the biblical text leaves enough ambiguity to suggest that not every dimension of that corruption was necessarily resolved in the same manner. So the terrestrial order was judged, the surface world was destroyed, and the deep seems to remain symbolically and textually mysterious, while post-flood giant traditions indicate that the problem reemerges in some form. William Reed was a guy who was obsessed with the mysteries of the polar regions. He was sort of this armchair explorer who was puzzled over why so many expeditions had come within a few hundred miles of the North Pole but had never reached it. This was in the early 1900s, and his conclusion, and the some of his associates as well, were that the poles had never been reached because they were unreachable. But Reed had faith in the existence of a hollow earth, and this led him into some very creative theorizing as to why the poles hadn't yet been reached. When most people hear that the earth is flattened at the poles, for example, they realize it means that the diameter of the earth at the equator, due to centrifugal force over many, many years, is slightly greater than its diameter at the poles. But Reed did not, or chose not to, understand this meaning, and he believed instead that if one looked at the Earth from a point several thousand miles over the equator, the polar regions would appear literally flat. Thus, he wrote, "Why is the Earth flattened at the poles? As the Earth is hollow, it could not be round," is the answer to that. Again, the opening to the interior would detract from its roundness, just in proportion to the size of the opening. His answers to the other questions were similarly reasoned as well. The aurora, as well as the polar meteor showers and the dust and stones found in Arctic ice, are all the light and debris of volcanic eruptions and forest fires in the interior world. The sun is not visible at the poles during the winter because the observer is within the opening. And Reed proposed that most icebergs are formed from fresh water within the verges and actually float out into the external seas, and as they drift southwards, they cause tidal waves. The poles, of course, had never been reached because they didn't even exist. The poles are but phantoms, Reed wrote. The earth is hollow, or all principle of reasoning must fail. And when he was asked what the interior of the earth was like, Reed admitted that he was hesitant to commit himself. He did, however, offer a few possibilities. He said, "From what I'm able to gather and from analysis, game of all kinds, tropical and arctic, will be found there, for both warm and cold climates must be in the interior. Warm inland and cold near the poles. Sea monsters and possibly the much talked of sea serpent may also be found, and vast territories of arable land for farming purposes. This theory is based on the great quantity of pollen that finds its way to the exterior of the earth and falls within the snow in such great quantities that it colors it, and thus produces the colored snow of the Arctic Circle. This would require millions of acres of land to grow. Minerals may be found in great quantities and game of all kinds. The earth contains minerals and gems, and they are likely to be in the interior of the earth as on the exterior. We may succeed, too, in finding large quantities of radium, which could be used to relieve the darkness if it should be unusually dark." Further confirmation of Admiral Byrd's discovery comes from reports of individuals who claim that they had entered the North Pole opening, as many explorers of the Arctic did without knowing it, and had penetrated far enough to reach the subterranean world in the hollow interior of the Earth. Dr. Nefi Khatam of Los Angeles reported that one of his patients, a man of Nordic descent, told him the following story. "I lived near the Arctic Circle in Norway. One summer, my friend and I made up our minds to take a boat trip together and go as far as we could into the North Country. So we put 1 month's food provisions in a small fishing boat, and with sail and also a good engine in our boat, we set to sea. At the end of 1 month, we had traveled far into the North, beyond the pole, and into a strange, new country. We were much astonished at the weather there, warm. And at times at night, it was almost too warm to sleep." Arctic explorers who penetrated into the far north have made similar reports of warm weather, at times warm enough to make them shed their heavy clothing. "Then we saw something so strange that we both were astonished. Then we saw something so strange that we both were astonished. Ahead of the warm, open sea, we were on what looked like a great mountain. Into that mountain, at a certain point, the ocean seemed to be emptying. Mystified, we continued in that direction and found ourselves sailing into a vast canyon leading into the interior of the earth. We kept sailing, and then we saw what surprised us, a sun shining inside the earth. The ocean that had carried us into the hollow interior of the earth gradually became a river. This river led, as we came to realize later, all through the inner surface of the world, from one end to the other. It can take you, if you follow it long enough, from the North Pole clear through to the South Pole. We saw that the inner surface of the earth was divided, as the other one is, into both land and water. There is plenty of sunshine, and both animal and vegetable life abounds there. We sailed further and further into this fantastic country. Fantastic because everything was huge in size as compared with things on the outside. Plants are big, trees gigantic, and finally we came to giants. They were dwelling in homes and towns, just as we do on the Earth's surface, and they used a type of electrical conveyance like a monorail car to transport people. It ran along the river's edge from town to town. Several of the inner Earth inhabitants, huge giants, detected our boat on the river, and we were quite amazed. They were, however, quite friendly, and we were invited to dine with them in their homes. And so my companion and I separated, he going with one giant to the giant's home and I going with another giant to his home. And my gigantic friend brought me home to his family, and I was completely dismayed to see the huge size of all the objects in his home. The dinner table was colossal. A plate was put before me and filled with a portion of food so big it would have fed me abundantly an entire week. The giant offered me a cluster of grapes, and each grape was as big as one of our peaches. I tasted outside. The giant offered me a cluster of grapes, and each grape was as big as one of our peaches I tasted outside. In the interior of the earth, all the fruits and vegetables taste far better and more flavorsome than those we have on the outer surface of the earth. We stayed with the giants for 1 year, enjoying their companionship as much as they enjoyed knowing us. We observed many strange and unusual things during our visit with these remarkable people, and were continually amazed at their scientific progress and inventions. All of this time, they were never unfriendly to us, and we were allowed to return to our own home in the same manner in which we came. In fact, they courteously offered their protection if we should need it for the return voyage. These giants were evidently members of the antediluvian race of Atlanteans who established residence in the Earth's interior prior to the historic deluge that submerged their Atlantic continent. A similar experience of a visit to the hollow interior of the Earth through the polar opening, and entirely independently, was also cited by another Norwegian named Olaf Jansson, and recorded in the book The Smoky God, written by Willis George Emerson, who was an American writer. The book is based on a report made by Jansson to Mr. Emerson before his death, describing his real experience of visiting the interior of the earth and its inhabitants. The title, The Smoky God, refers to the central sun in the hollow interior of the earth, which, being smaller and less brilliant than our sun, appears as smoky. And that story of the Smoky God is pretty interesting if you feel like seeking it out and reading it. It's free. You can find it on the archive and stuff like that. Interestingly enough, especially when we consider that the Hollow Earth is most likely the location for several demon kingdoms and primarily the realm of hidden fallen angels and their tech, it's interesting what we sometimes hear about going on in there. In September 1943, in Chicago, Amazing Stories editor Ray Palmer read a letter from a Bartow, Pennsylvania, reader who claimed to know of an ancient alphabet from Lemuria. This was a continent said to have sunk in the Pacific Ocean thousands of years ago and taking a mighty civilization with it. In fact, the idea of Lemuria was invented in the 19th century, first by biologist Ernest Haeckel as a hypothetical home for the original Homo sapiens, and then of course elaborated on by Blavatsky in her imaginative History of the Human Race. But there doesn't seem to actually be any geological or biological evidence that this place ever actually existed. It's up for debate. But Palmer reprinted the alphabet in the January 1944 issue, and soon he and the reader, Shaver, were corresponding regularly. Shaver alleged that for years he was tormented by evil creatures known as Deros, which was short for detrimental robots, who were not robots, as the term is ordinarily understood, but robots in the sense of being slaves to their passions. Deros were the degenerate remnants of the Titans, the people of Lemuria, who 12,000 years ago were forced to escape into great caverns under the earth to avoid deadly radiation from the sun. Some Titans, however, stayed on the surface. They adjusted and became the present human race. Others fled to distant planets. Deros, demons, and all but name and close to it, even there, were sadistic idiots who had access to the advanced Titan technology, which they used to increase sexual pleasure during the orgies to which they were addicted. And they also used the machines in marathon torture sessions on kidnapped surface people and also on the Teros, these integrative robots who were not robots but good Titans who, though vastly outnumbered, were fighting the Deros. And they also employed the machines to cause accidents and madness and other miseries in the world above the caves. Okay, so once again, we are on the same page here that the inner earth is probably a Nephilim death kingdom disguised as a beautiful Atlantean empire. Modern imagination often remembers the flood almost exclusively as rain, as though divine judgment from God descended only from above. But Genesis describes something way more severe, way more complex. In Genesis 7:11, the destruction begins not only when the windows of heaven are open, but also when all the fountains of the great deep are broken up. And the deluge is therefore not just weather. It's not weather alone. It is a complete rupture of the planet. Judgment pours downward from the heavens and erupts upwards from beneath the earth. And if that actually happened in the past, would that not mean that now there is some kind of void inside the earth because the fountains of the deep expelled so much of the inner earth water to the surface? I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here. But Psalm 33 says that God gathers the waters and lays up the depth in storehouses. This is interesting language. The deep is imagined not as chaos running free, but as something bounded, reserved, and governed. It's a hidden place, but it's not meaningless, and it belongs to the domain over which God rules absolutely, even when it remains concealed from man. And that's really interesting when you ponder the bottom of the ocean and the ocean realm, I think. The poetic and the wisdom texts also expand upon this. Job speaks of dead things from under the waters and immediately declares that hell is naked before God. Proverbs refers to the depths of hell. Isaiah says that hell from beneath is moved to meet the king of Babylon. The Psalms speak of the wicked descending into the lower parts of the earth. And of course, these expressions could be considered nothing more than poetry. But biblical poetry is not decorative language, if you will, without some kind of substance. It reveals how reality is being imagined, and what it reveals repeatedly is that below the ordinary world of human life, there appears to exist a realm associated with death, horror, humiliation, judgment, imprisonment, and exposure before God. Remember when Legion retreated into the sea? I guess they didn't really retreat, but they, you know, the pigs, in an effort to, as they were just totally flooded with demons, the pigs ran off a cliff into the sea and drowned. Leviathan of the deep as well. You have Leviathan. You have all these stories of things coming out of the deep. Then you have the story of Korah's rebellion. This is a kind of a niche story, but in Numbers 16, the punishment is not simply that the rebels die. Korra thought that he could do a better job leading the people than Moses was doing. But by leading this revolt against God's divinely appointed leaders, Korra was actually revolting against God, obviously. You can find this story in November's 16, 11. Moses proposed a test, therefore, to prove the source of his authority. So Korra and his followers, as expected, did not pass the test, and God opened up the earth and swallowed all the rebels, their families, and all their possessions. And then after that, fire came out from the Lord and consumed the other 250 guys who were part of Korah's rebellion. The earth is not merely the place where judgment occurs. It becomes an active participant in judgment. It opens, it receives, it expels, it swallows. So in biblical thought, the world beneath the surface is not some inert place. It can function as a zone that sort of seems to behave as a prison, but also sometimes as divine retribution and a place to hide where you think you're hidden, but you're only hidden from the surface dwellers. You're not hidden from God. Regardless of that, if you're waiting for your judgment and you're trying to remain hidden from humanity in your physical form, inside the earth might be the best place for ya, especially if you can't, for whatever reason, leave this realm that you're in, this plane that you're in, for whatever reason. If you can't get back to heaven, you're probably going to find a different place that is separate from humanity, but also separate from heaven, from where you can rule. Because if you consider yourself lofty and above the humans, to me, it only makes sense that you would want your own place without any humans. After all, that's what we see the gods do in all the stories. That's what we see the predatory elite do. They have their own little areas. They buy up entire Hawaiian islands and all this kind of stuff. They have their own secret lands where only they can go. Who do you think taught them that? Who do you think they got the value of that from? Well, probably the fallen angels, the Nephilim, the gods that came before that made humanity what it is today and now may reside somewhere inside the earth. The New Testament doesn't abandon this vision of reality either. If anything, it preserves it in an even more concentrated form, because Paul writes in Ephesians that Christ descended first into the lower parts of the earth. Once again, we are seeing the lower regions being treated as meaningful places within biblical cosmology. Philippians also expands this frame even further by declaring that every knee will bow to Christ, those in heaven, those on earth, and those under the earth. Now, is he talking about people who are buried, who have already died? But it implies that the authority of Christ is not restricted to heaven above and humanity on the surface. His dominion extends downward as well into the hidden or lower realms of creation. And the book of Revelation takes all of this underworld imagery and runs with it. We know there is the abyss or the bottomless pit. This is not some metaphor without content, I don't think. It's a place of confinement. It's a literal sealed region that can be opened at the appointed time. And smoke rises from it like a furnace, and destructive beings emerge from within. And later, Satan is bound and shut up in that same abyss. So this underworld is not only associated with the dead, it's also connected with imprisonment and containment and eschatological release and divine judgment that is being placed upon spiritual entities and who knows what else. But beneath the ordinary world, there does appear to be a realm that is bound up with divine judgment and the restrained presence of hostile powers. And then you have Jonah's prayer, which offers another important example. When Jonah cries from the belly of the fish, he describes his experience in language that blends the sea and death and depth and underworld imagery. And of course he would. He's been swallowed by a giant fish and is just being submarined about where he has no idea where. But he speaks of crying out of the belly of hell, of being cast into the deep, and of descending to the roots of the mountains. And I don't think this is normal language of fear. It's the language of being pushed beneath the normal order of life into a place of confinement from which only God can deliver. I think there was something very special about the fact that he was eaten by a fish. He was meant to experience the abyss. And so once again, what lies below is not spiritually vacant. It's a place where human power fails completely, and there is some sort of divine sovereignty, I think. Even in a lot of these stories about the Lemurians and, you know, Agartha and Atlantis, all these things, they're talking about these beings that are divine when they get there. They're not talking about normal humans. They're not talking about feral people. They're divine entities that are always there. Only in like these weird horror movies do we get these stories of like these orc-like beings that live and they like are all like nasty and everything and all that kind of stuff. But when you actually look at all the literary accounts, not all of them, obviously, but a great many of them are describing some sort of majestic entity that lives in the earth. So, the Bible might not offer any real speculative doctrine of the inner earth, but it does give you something to think about when we ponder the architecture of our known world. It gives us this vision in which the depths below are morally and spiritually significant. And it gives us the space to ponder how the giants may have survived the flood. And when discussing the concept of watchers and angels and demons chained in the abyss and beneath the mountains and in the deserts and beneath the Tigris and the Euphrates, it really does seem like there's something down there, guys. The world beneath the surface is not something that the Bible fails to mention, and it doesn't really seem like a good place to be, regardless of the fact that it is subject to the same divine sovereignty that rules the heavens above. Did this episode change anything for you? I didn't want to do just a boring, regular inner earth thing, hollow earth thing. And some of the stuff that I found, you know, I've never worded it in this way before, and I haven't seen it worded in this way before. And so I found it, you know, interesting enough to turn into an episode. But hope you guys enjoyed it, regardless of whether or not it did anything for you. I enjoyed hanging out with you. Stay safe out there, guys. And remember, the life is in the blood.